For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
We see patients who are in a very poor state, and when they completely stop drinking and when they engage in healthcare, the positive transformation that they can undergo is almost unbelievable.
That was the voice of Professor Paul Haber, who is Clinical Director of Drug Health Services for the Sydney Local Health District and is Professor of Addiction Medicine at the University of Sydney's Central Clinical School. Professor Haber and his colleagues have produced a 5-chapter supplement for the MJA, which summarises the new Australian guidelines for the treatment of alcohol problems. The guidelines have been refined to cater for more specific at-risk groups, and the supplement details those refinements. The supplement is available at mja.com.au and is free to access. The full web address is in the show notes for this podcast. Also available is a co-authored editorial by Professor Haber, and the full address for that article is also in the show notes, along with a link to the full guidelines. I invited Professor Haber along to talk about the management of alcohol disorders in Australia in 2021. At the time of recording, I was labouring under the head cold from hell, so please excuse my slightly less than dulcet tones. Do we know the prevalence of alcohol use disorder in Australia?
There are varying estimates. Approximately 1 million people have an alcohol use disorder, but it depends a little bit on how you define it. We have different diagnostic criteria, DSM-5, and we have the ICD-11, and then we have the previous versions of those systems. And so if you look at all of those different systems, you get slightly different answers.
Are Australians drinking more often, or are we drinking problematically more often?
So it's a little bit hard to get accurate trends because the National Household Survey has become slightly less successful at representing the entire population. So the inverted commas, the official data may or may not totally reflect the population. But those data suggest that whilst young people drink the most, that they are probably drinking a bit less than they were a few years ago, and that whilst old people drink the least, they drink more often than young people, but in lower amounts, and they are starting to drink more. What we have is a total population that, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, is drinking a bit less than it was 5 years ago. The total amount of harms and the total number of people are being admitted to hospital is not getting less. Well, first of all, it suggests that there's a little bit of a paradox in there somewhere. One possible explanation is that the people who drink dangerously and harmfully are continuing to do so, and that the reduction in overall consumption comes from low-risk drinkers reducing a little bit less, but they were never going to get into trouble from their alcohol anyway, and so it has no favourable impact on harms. Basically, it's a problem if you take the average of the whole community. It doesn't necessarily reflect what's happening under the surface.
The editorial you've written goes with a supplement that we're putting out with your group. And basically, it's about updated Australian guidelines for the treatment of alcohol problems. Are there big changes to practice recommended in those guidelines?
There are refinements across the board, and there are also recognition that certain population groups have not been carefully considered in previous versions of the guidelines. So by including them, we've become more comprehensive in the work we do.
Which groups are at high risk?
Young people are at high risk for episodic heavy drinking, but other groups at high risk include LGBTQI groups. Aboriginal people are at higher risk, but it's always important for us to remember that the Aboriginal community is a small proportion of the overall community. So even if they are at a bit of a higher risk, the majority of people in hospital with an alcohol problem are not Aboriginal at all. And also that the distribution of alcohol use amongst Aboriginal people is different from the rest of the community. And in particular, they have a much higher rate of complete abstinence from alcohol. So they are much more likely to drink zero alcohol than non-Aboriginal community, but if they do drink, they are more likely to get into difficulty.
Is it too early to know what effect COVID-19's had?
No, it's not too early. There have been publications around the world on this, and we have our own experience from hospitals. Different parts of the world, first of all, declared alcohol as either a banned substance, like South Africa said they banned sales of alcohol during COVID, or in Australia, it was declared as an essential substance, and alcohol sales were protected during COVID. So we have a spectrum of national responses to alcohol during COVID. That's the first point. That's availability. A lot of people changed their pattern of drinking. So a lot of people never drank alcohol in the home. And so for some of those people, they were at home, so they didn't drink. Then there are others who started to drink at home. There are many who increased their consumption of alcohol whilst at home. And we also have many people who had problems with alcohol for one reason or another, either whether it was stress or another reason, they wind up relapsing and getting into more problems. So we've had a lot of presentations to hospital with alcohol-related problems, but we've also had a bunch of other people who are drinking less. So I don't think there's an overall one-size-fits-all, but we've had a range of responses.
I'm talking today with Professor Paul Haber, who is Chair of Addiction Medicine at the University of Sydney, about alcohol problems in Australia. If this podcast has brought up issues for you, we recommend you talk with your own GP about pathways to specialised help in your state. Alcoholics Anonymous is available at 1300 222 222 and the National Alcohol and Other Drugs Hotline is open 24/7 at 1800 250 015. The supplement and editorial produced by Professor Haber and his colleagues are available at mja.com.au and are both free to access. Full web addresses are available in the show notes for this podcast. Back to our chat. It sounds easy on paper to identify people with an alcohol problem. Is it easy in practice?
It's one of the conundrums of this field because, as you've said, it is extremely easy to ask one or two or three questions, and our guidelines give both advice and recommendations about doing that. And we're not the first to do so. It's perfectly easy to do, but we know that in practice, only about half the time are these questions being done. There's a very significant under-recognition of alcohol use disorder in a range of settings, although if you put your mind to it, it's fairly straightforward to do.
One of the figures you quote in your editorial that really struck me was that there's a delay, the average delay from problem to treatment is 18 years. Why is that so long? Is it about stigma? Is it about under-recognition?
I think if I had to put my finger on any one thing, I think the stigma and the reluctance to admit that a person has this problem would be the single biggest factor. But these are data from National Strategy of Mental Health and Wellbeing reported by Marie Thiessen, my colleague, and others, and have been replicated around the world, by the way. Same problem in the United States. So it's a pervasive problem, and I think that stigma is one issue. The other is recognition of the spectrum of alcohol problems is still not great. So people still have in their mind what we would call a skid row alcoholic as a concept, and that severe end of the spectrum would only reflect perhaps 10% of the range of alcohol problems that one sees.
Are we asking the question enough?
We're not asking practice? The question enough in practice. There is also the problem of what we do if we get the answer that we didn't want to hear. One of the reasons that people don't ask is that they're a bit diffident about what to do next if the patient fesses up that there is a problem. And so increasing understanding about how to respond to alcohol problems, whether it's in primary care or in any other clinical setting, is one of our challenges. We hope that we've provided some of the answers to that in the guideline documents and the associated website. But knowledge and skills and confidence are not all the same thing.
Are GPs the ones best placed to detect and treat alcohol use disorder?
GPs probably are the best place to detect alcohol problems and to either treat or provide brief advice when the problems are not terribly severe. But I think it is fair to say that the more severe problems or the problems that don't respond to treatment start to fall outside the range of what the reasonable GP could be expected to be doing. And so phase two of the operation is for GPs to identify patients who should be referred and to identify pathways for those referrals and to place the patient in specialist hands where that's needed.
Does each state have a different pathway or is there a commonality across the country?
The pathways, I'm not going to say it's like the roadmap out of COVID, but the pathways are not straightforward. It is true to say that in New South Wales, we have a relatively large public sector, public health sector. We have a group of specialists in addiction medicine. We have a group of specialists in addiction psychiatry. And the other states in Australia don't match that. And so the pathways do differ. We also have the non-government sector. We have the private sector, private hospital and private specialist sector. And these are incredibly patchy in their distribution.
I know there are comorbidities that go along with alcohol problems. Is there a comorbidity that pops up where a GP can go, they've got that, therefore they must have that? Is that a way into the conversation, I guess?
A way into the conversation. That's a good point. That is, alcohol problems are more likely to be present in a person who's got mental health problems, in a person who presents with high blood pressure, particularly for the first time, and in a person with potentially alcohol-related problems like raised liver function tests or a case of Monday-itis, so to speak. I would like to highlight that on the one hand, this is a disorder that tends to be stigmatized, underdiagnosed, undertreated. You know, there's a lot of challenges ahead of us to get our systems up to the standard we would like them to be. But on a positive note, we see patients who are in a very poor state. And when they completely stop drinking and when they engage in healthcare, the positive transformation that they can undergo is almost unbelievable. And we can take people from, you know, literally death's door back to high functioning, happy, and a successful life. And I think that's the blue sky in this whole field, which is that it is not hopeless.
It's not easy.
No,
mind you.
No. It can be extremely difficult, and yet the only one that can really drive change is the patient, him or herself. And when they make that decision to really turn things around, it's striking how quickly and how dramatically that can be.
If there was one thing you could fix right now that would make things better, either for doctors or patients, what would it be, Paul? What would you like to do if you were king for the day?
I think it's a long journey to bring treatment of alcohol problems into the light. I think if you think about how mental health have gone about destigmatizing, enhancing, promoting and developing mental health care, they've gone a long way in the past 20, 30 years, and we're about 20 or 30 years behind them. So I think when I graduated, you wouldn't have considered that mental health care would be so mainstream and so effective. And I think that provides the signposts that we can achieve similarly excellent progress over the future if we put our minds to it.
Thank you for your time. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.